Concentrate. Keep it in mind. Come on, I gotta find a pen. Write this down. Exactly what happened. Come on. I gotta find a pen. Jeez, come on. Keep focused. Keep it in mind. Come on, find a pen. Write this down. Write down what happened. Write it down. Come on, concentrate. Keep in mind. Find a pen.
What happened?
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Can you remember your first day of school? Try to picture it. Did it suck? Probably. Whatever pictures are coming to your minds might seem like singular memories, but they're actually complex constructions of numerous memory traces that span across several regions of your brains.
Brain!
This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks, the only show you're listening to right now. Hopefully. Oh, good heavens, be realistic. So anyway, we continue today with our May theme, memory conditioning, hashtag memory condition. I look forward to your thoughts and questions in our Facebook group or on Twitter. I said at the end of the last show that we were going to talk about the memory system in detail today, and I've decided, because I want to keep each one of these episodes as brief as possible. We're going to come back to that in a minute, but I'm going to split this specific discussion into three parts. The first two parts are going to talk about areas of the brain that participate in the memory process. So today we are going to do the prefrontal cortex, the frontal lobes, and the amygdala. And then in the second show, we're going to do basal ganglia, hippocampus, and cerebellum. Bam! And then in the third part of the memory system discussion, we will deal with that process specifically. So as we go through each part of the brain, I'm going to talk about what role in the memory system that part plays, and even some strategies for strengthening or improving that specific function. So, yes, keeping the show brief. You know, one of the nicest compliments I ever got about the School Sucks program here is that I am respectful of people's time. I put a lot of work into the show, and in exchange, I ask for a fairly modest monthly contribution, which is now $8 a month. As we've, you know, built up a fine collection of additional content in our AV club, I ask people to contribute $8 a month. Consider it a cost of living raise. You know, I want people to come to the School Sucks Project website in the future and say there's a lot of valuable alternative educational resources here, and I'm, trying to spend this year building them. And I am trying to produce a repertoire of actionable podcast collections, productivity, principles of learning anything, creativity, memory, and there's more to come. This is the fourth one. There's five more. We'll do five more of these themes before the end of the year. So if you think there are things that I could do differently, or there's things that aren't on the show that you would like on the show, consider hitting me up. But just, you know, part of the, I don't know what you thought of the introduction to this series, but 40-something minutes long, that started as an 100-minute recording. You know, after I recorded it, I like to remember that compliment that I received once, you are respectful of other people's time. So I edited it as much as I could, leaving only the essential information. And after I put it out, I downloaded it and I took it with me when I went birdwatching. Yeah, I go birdwatching. So many birds here. You should see them. And, you know, when you live in the city, it's just pigeons and crows. Crow is a very smart bird, by the way. I do know a thing or two about birds. Crows never get hit by cars. A lot of people don't know this. Whenever there's a crow in the road, there's always another one on the side of the road saying, caw, caw. And some of you might be saying, Brett, you're not really being respectful of my time right now. That's fine. Let's move along. I'm just saying, if you can manage to support the show, it would be greatly appreciated. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. We ask for $8 a month. You get access to a ton of additional stuff. If you are one of these Richards, these one percenters, we do have higher levels, $12 and $16 a month. And that does get you a little extra access. There's, you know, levels of content availability in our bonus section. So I definitely appreciate that. And I will try to earn it. And, you know, don't hesitate to tell me how I can do a better job of earning it. You can post it right in the School Sucks Facebook group. Right in front of everybody. Don't be shy. So anyway, let's get to today's show. One of the things that we're going to be talking about in the next installment, your memory system, the process in a nutshell, external events occur in front of you. You have five senses through which they can be processed. I was concerned about when it comes to making memories, a kind of sensory dullness that I was experiencing. And in the last discussion, I partially pinned it on an over-reliance on memory aids like the GTD system and programs like Evernote. And I, you know, ran around at many moments in life feeling like Leonard from Memento. And if you haven't seen Memento, I'm going to be very careful. This movie is 16 years old, and I feel like it should be okay to spoil it. But I'm going to be very, very careful about not spoiling it because you need to experience this movie. You have not lived unless you've seen Christopher Nolan's movie Memento. You have lived. I don't want to, you know, invalidate your experiences, your life experiences outside of viewing Memento. But see it. See Memento. So there's this scene in Memento where Leonard, the protagonist, or is he really the protagonist? Should you really be rooting for him? Maybe. Maybe not. It's hard to tell. Most of the movie, you don't know any more about what's going on than he does. He can't make new memories. He can remember many details about his life, his past, who he is. He has a personality, but can't remember anything for more than a couple of minutes. So he has a working memory, but he has no long-term memory. So everything just kind of fades after a couple of minutes, and he comes up with a very elaborate system of trying to capture and retain information about what happens to him as he tries to solve a mystery in his life. There's a scene in the movie where somebody says, I'm going to take advantage of you. And because you're such a retard, she uses the word retard. This was back in the year 2000 when it was still okay to say retard. I'm going to take advantage of you, Leonard, and there's nothing you can do about it because she hid all the pens in the place where she tells him this, and then she leaves. So he goes running around trying to find a pen. He's saying, keep it in your mind, keep it in your mind, keep it in your mind, keep it in your mind. And I recently rewatched this because I was with somebody who had never seen the movie before, and I said, oh, I'll watch it for the 59th time. And I don't know, something just clicked. So I really identified with that part of the movie after becoming so, in many ways, dependent on my capture system of Evernote. And I still, you know, I'm saying this and I'm being repetitive about this because give me some feedback. Let me know what you think about this. Is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Am I just resisting the future shock world? Am I supposed to embrace the merging and the harmony of machine and man? Am I a fool to sit here saying, oh, when I was 12, I remembered phone numbers and baseball stats and just move on? Just embrace the future. But I feel like Leonard sometimes, you know, having to pull out my phone or run to my computer to say, oh, don't let this go. Don't let this go. I repainted the studio table with a chalkboard service and bought some chalk. I don't know how I feel about that. Could get a little bit dusty in here, but just an extra immediate capture tool. I'm staring at a stack of pink Post-its right now, covered with time codes from the last show. So I got plenty of capture devices, and I don't know, I really connected with Leonard in Memento when he scrambled around looking for a pen. And this was a problem that I was trying to address with my research that is ultimately being distilled down into this podcast series. So I felt like the over-reliance on these systems was producing a lack of alertness for capture. We talked about this in the last show. But once memories are captured, they go into a holding area. This often used to be referred to as the short-term memory. Today, we call it the working memory. For a long time, 7 has been the magic number of items that the working memory can hold at a single time. If these items are not given special attention, they will start to fade away after about a minute. From the working memory, items that are on their way to becoming as permanent as memories can be go through what is called the central processor, which controls how much attention is given to the contents of the working memory. Through repetition and rehearsal, working memory items can become long-term memories where they are stored and potentially available for recall. So those are the basics. And in the next episode, we're going to go through that process in great detail. But these memory functions happen throughout the brain. Obviously, there is a tremendous amount of interconnectivity. And because of that, I wanted to go through the brain by its parts to talk about what each part does. And then you can decide, based on the descriptions that I give of each part of the brain and its function in memory, where there is room for improvement for you. And I'm going to give strategies for improvement related to each part of the brain and its specific function. Now, if you know anything about neurology, and I'm going to assume that you don't, I really hope I'm not being overly passé, but this is going to be a very, very basic introduction into the memory functions of the brain. So I hope this is useful review. A lot of this stuff, if you took like a core curriculum psychology class in high school or college, some of it might start to come back, but we're going to try to add some actionable and helpful detail to each part. So many of you probably remember the hippocampus, probably the most important part of the brain when it comes to the memory process, but we're going to start at the physical front of the brain and work backwards. First, the prefrontal cortex, which helps with spatial navigation and declarative learning and memory. Now, most of my professional experience actually deals with this part of the brain. When I was a teacher, many of the students that I worked with had been diagnosed with learning disabilities. And this was also one of the many challenges that I was trying to support as an academic tutor. When people are diagnosed with dyslexia, ADHD, they often struggle with what is called executive function skills, which creates significant challenges in remembering important details, along with strategic planning, organization, and of course, ultimately completing tasks. This was often explained to us way back in the day. And when I was teaching and at the beginning of my tutoring career, everything was executive functioning. It was all anybody talked about. It was on every IEP. But we were taught to think about it like the orchestra conductor of the brain. It activates awareness. It is highly responsible for self-regulation and direction and coordination of the variety of cognitive skills that are necessary for functioning and assessing things in real time. It helps with sorting different tasks and collecting them into goals. And strong executive functioning skills, I've found, are actually a big part of a person's self-assessment as an in-charge, in-control, self-directed learner. So when I was a tutor, the core strategies for trying to help kids with executive functioning issues, encouraging proactivity, streamlining, making sure that whatever the amount of things to process at a given time was manageable, and setting goals. This is where organization and productivity systems are really, really helpful for setting a framework or creating an example of strong executive functioning. So I could run through a list of strategies that we would use as teachers and tutors to try to expand or improve executive functioning in school settings. And then I'm going to tell you one thing that I think, from my experience and research, really works. But I'll run through these others as well. Number one, making the concept explicit. Knowing what this concept is can create a mindfulness about it, I found. These are abilities that can be developed. So to tell a student, or even to tell yourself, that your brain has a part that functions like the conductor of an orchestra, or this is, you know, perhaps it creates some more messy visuals, but an air traffic controller. And then to know that that part of the brain exists, I think helps to make sense of a lot of the scatter that for so many people, especially young people, is just completely mysterious and undefined. This next one, which is right out of teaching and tutoring, but relates to people who are parents. If you feel that your child or children struggle with the executive functioning issues, being or modeling a healthy prefrontal cortex for them, not in a way where they become dependent on you, but, you know, I mean, this was a part of teaching, having a dry erase board with, you know, the daily schedule written out, being proactive about problems that could occur, having a contingency plan for when problems did occur. Structure and organization are very, very, very helpful. Quieting the external chaos. And this is where, you know, capture devices like Evernote, dry erase boards, a program like GTD that I think, as David Allen said when he was on the show, can be implemented with young children is really, really helpful. So you're building basically a productive learning environment for a child, for yourself, by minimizing the external chaos, because you don't really have much of a chance at building, you know, stronger executive functioning or a stronger working memory that's really an integral part of this if there's nothing but noise outside of it. So if you're doing education at home or you're self-educating, having a well-organized learning environment and with some degree of predictability is really, really helpful here. And in teaching, you know, this was one of the things that became a very, very important theme in the School Sucks show, getting away from this top-down approach, moving from schooling to self-education. The more choices kids had in any of the environments in which I worked, the more motivated they generally were. And motivated learners have a much better chance of being self-directed learners. And self-direction is like the key to strong executive functioning. The more time they can spend in that mindset, or the more time we can spend, all of us, in that mindset, the more helpful it is going to be in the, you know, the organization and management of our thoughts and tasks. So that's going way back. That's, you know, 15 years back in my career, all of that information. What is most helpful? Physical activity and exercise. So in the early days of my career, when I worked at that boarding school, I worked in two very different environments. I started working in the dorms, and that was a nightmare. But after that, I got moved to doing outdoor education. And after a couple of years, I worked my way up to being in charge of a campus where I was basically the lead teacher, where I was in a classroom all day until I changed school to half the day. We were supposed to do school from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. with an hour break for lunch. And what I did in my second year of teaching, after realizing how absolutely suboptimal that was for everybody involved, me, my staff, the students, the second year, we did more of a life skills curriculum and would use the afternoons for recreation. We'd play football. And if we had a newspaper deadline, I had the kids working on a newspaper, we might have to devote some afternoons to that. So I had learned a lot by my second year, but my observations before that, because I worked at the school like 3 or 4 years before that happened, I spent some time as a teacher's aide, and I spent time doing outdoor education, taking kids skiing, taking kids kayaking. And what I found was these same students that I would work with in the school setting were so much happier and more enjoyable to be around and successful and animated in those situations where they could move, where they weren't stuck in a desk. Now, these were all boys. So, you know, and boys and girls are different, especially at that age. But those opportunities to find and solve your own problems through physical movement or sport or recreation, took these kids from situations where they were deliberately shutting their brains off to, it was basically like watching in these two different settings, going outside and doing these things. It was like watching corpses come to life. No, that sounds terrifying, because what I'm trying to describe is quite triumphant, actually. It was like watching zombies return to regular happy people. There we go. Much better. And I know we talked about this on the show before. 14 was the optimal age for learning new information. And studies show that executive functioning reaches its peak levels at around this time as well. So studies have shown that young adults who exercise regularly have quicker reaction times, they give more accurate responses, are more effective at detecting errors when working at a fast pace. And if you're like an adult, like my age, research suggests aerobic exercise can boost the executive functions that often deteriorate with age, including the ability to pay attention, one of the very important themes this month, switch between tasks quickly, which is something many of us are required to do in our work, and to hold multiple items in the working memory simultaneously. And one study, and I'm going to link to all of these studies in the show notes if you want to take a look. In one study, adults did 3 one-hour sessions of exercise a week for a period of 6 months. Brain scans were done before and after the six-month period, and the scans showed substantial increases in activity and in gray and white matter in the area of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, associated with executive control. So if you feel scattered, if you feel like your working memory is not what it used to be, if you have trouble switching between tasks effectively and quickly, the important takeaway would be to ask yourself if you're moving enough. And you know, we touched on this in the productivity series, the Pomodoro method. If you have a job where you have to sit, like especially if you're your own boss, if you work from home, you could wind up, if you ask me, a person could wind up sitting for 4 hours straight and not even notice that they did it. This is no good. So, you know, breaking up your work, 25-minute blocks, 45-minute blocks, an hour block. I mean, it's different for everybody. You can customize it. Getting up and just, I find, walking around for 10 minutes, going outside, doing a quick stroll, getting in. You know, if you walk briskly, you could get in 800, 900, 1,000 paces during that time. Really, really helpful. It's helpful to reset. But, you know, I've really tried to make a conscious effort over the course of the last year to have my body moving more. And I really, really cracked down on myself as far as quantifying this in 2016. And I feel like when I do it, when I stick to it, it really helps me. So there you go. Physical activity for the expansion of working memory and executive functioning. In the show notes, I'll also include a piece from Psychology Today by Dr. Timothy Pichel, P-Y-C-H-Y-L. Let's call him Timothy Pickle. Strategies to improve executive function, and this piece deals specifically with developing skills to reduce procrastination. We also did a series on procrastination. It was in January of 2015. It's called Stop Procrastinating Now or Soon, and it is available in the School Sucks archives. If you feel like procrastination is part of your problem, it does relate to executive functioning, I would recommend checking out that series as well. So let's move back in the brain to the frontal lobes, which are responsible for working and prospective memory. So working memory, you know what that is, happening in the prefrontal cortex, as we just discussed with executive functioning, but also many aspects of it in the frontal lobes. Prospective memory is when you remember to perform an action at the right time, remembering to remember, remembering to take medication. So when I talked about, you know, going out and doing errands and forgetting the grape drink, prospective memory is the aspect of memory employed in doing that task successfully. So the frontal lobe is important for learning, obviously, but also emotional control. And there's often 3 functions that are associated with this lobe called the 3 T's: tension, tact, and tenacity. So tension is the unique ability of the human being to persist beyond initial emotional responses and other primitive behaviors. In other words, to be something more than just stimulus response. Tact, the second T, is the ability to understand and apply socially acceptable behaviors And tenacity is persistence, essentially, the ability to focus on one thing for an extended period of time. So this was also part of the discussion back in the days of my career when we talked about things like ADHD. So how can we maximize the function of these frontal lobes of ours? A big one that I've learned in the last couple years, mindfulness, paying attention, practicing paying attention to sensory experience, actively seeking new challenges on a daily basis. I can't think of one podcast that I currently listen to where I, you know, evaluate the host and I say, oh, me and this guy are peas in a pod, ideologically. Been listening to Cantwell. We talked about that on the show in the past. Sorry. Milo Yiannopoulos, Gavin McGinnis, Duncan Trussell. Holy shit, this guy. Now, all these guys are great, massively entertaining. I still check in with Bill Maher once in a while in his real-time show. Ann Coulter, I find myself being more and more curious about her. So the prerequisite is intelligence. But if people are talking about, you know, political, philosophical issues, I don't want to be spending my media consumption time on automatic pilot. Another huge one, an evaluation of how much information you are actually being exposed to. I still have these bad habits with research where I'll switch over from Evernote, where I, you know, build outlines for shows, to Firefox, and I'll realize I've got like 40 tabs open. That is a complete waste of RAM on my computer, even having that program open, because it's going to become a time sink to go through all of those tabs and figure out, you know, why they're open, if they can be closed, if they should be Evernote web clippered into, you know, some remind me later type place. But that deluge of information, what we called in the last show, information overload, almost produces this kind of freeze in my brain anyway. And really, it's not just that I'm wasting time trying to figure out why I have so many things open or what each one of them means. And this doesn't happen all the time, but still happens occasionally. Clear thinking and decision making are virtually impossible in that situation. So I try not to overwhelm myself with too much information. And I try to be pretty conscious of not overwhelming the audience with too much information. So your frontal lobes basically set out to focus on important data, but also to know what can be discarded. So the frontal lobe, in short, plays a very strategic role in learning. They also bear a great deal of the responsibility in abstracting. Some of you might remember that Gino Denning and I, in the Trivium series we did in 2013, we talked about three levels of consciousness. I'm actually going to put them into a later show. But the highest level of consciousness is conceptual, which is, you know, forming an abstract idea generalized from the memory of two or more percepts. And when you're trying to remember too many details, too many percepts at a given time, or you're just juggling too many of them in internet windows, you're reducing the efficiency of the frontal lobe function. So for me, what was helpful is to pay closer attention to how I'm trying to learn. And there's so many challenges to this in the very, very information and, you know, pseudo information rich world in which we live. So it's something to be very careful and thoughtful about. So those are three strategies: avoiding automatic pilot by being really mindful and being conscious of information exposure and being deliberate about, you know, information management, really, really essential to a healthy frontal lobe of the brain. So we continue to move further back to the amygdala. And for those of you who have some knowledge of the brain and also some history of struggles with anxiety, you might be saying my amygdala actually helps me in some ways. Yes, it actually does. What is the amygdala, first of all? The amygdala is situated towards the middle bottom of the brain. It's a set of small kind of almondy clusters. No, that sounds too delicious. Clusters of nuclei, let's say. And this region becomes most active when we experience fear or aggression. The amygdala, thus, is primarily responsible for triggering the body's fight or flight response. Now, I mentioned anxiety. Things like panic attacks happen when either external stressors or emotional stressors convince the amygdala that we are in some kind of danger. So anxiety and anxiety attacks actually start here. Now, before we get to the helpful things, the basic process of amygdala function, there's some kind of catalyst, the trigger, automatic negative thoughts, some kind of disturbing sensory perception. The trigger can be entirely inside you and not even real at all. It can be purely subconscious. So the amygdala reaction prepares us to respond to this thing, real or not. If you've ever listened to the Free Domain Radio Bomb in the Brain series, the amygdala is star, one of the star characters in those talks. Because often the triggers can be related to deeply emotional past experiences. They're kind of stirred up in this process. So when the amygdala produces this response, you get this adrenal action where epinephrine is released into your bloodstream, similar to adrenaline. It makes everything going on inside you speed up, often in a kind of uncomfortable way. Your blood sugar spikes. Some people start shaking or trembling. You might feel heart palpitations, facial flushing, hyperventilation, chest pain. And that sucks. But the amygdala just wants to keep you safe. But an overreactive amygdala basically produces an anxiety disorder. So that's all unfortunate, but the amygdala also plays a very important role in memory modulation. So anytime you learn something, as we're going to discuss in a future episode about your memory system, the long-term memory, if there is going to be one, is not formed right away. Now here's how this works. During the consolidation period of any memory, the amygdala, of course, being very emotional, influences the strength of the memory trace. The more emotionally aroused we are following the learning of something, the greater chance there is for retention of that event or that piece of knowledge. So in short, the amygdala carries some responsibility for determining what memories are stored and where memories are stored in the brain. And this determination is based on how large the emotional response is to a certain event or piece of information or collection of information. So how do we tame this thing? When I was investigating this issue of anxiety, you know, I've talked about having some anxiety problems on the show before. I approached the problem from three distinct angles. The first one was biological, the second one was behavioral, and the third was psychodynamic. So a biological theory of anxiety suggests that there's a chemical imbalance in the brain. There could possibly be a genetic or nurture contribution to this type of anxiety. Resources for that would be the Free Domain Radio series Bomb in the Brain. And Alice Miller, even in books like The Truth Will Set You Free, talked about storing emotional pain as a kind of recurring physical discomfort. But what I kept coming back to in my research was the importance of diet. And the basics were, for a healthy amygdala and lower levels of anxiety, avoiding processed foods, avoiding caffeine, avoiding alcohol, eating fatty fish high in omega-3, like salmon, beef, turkey, Greek yogurt, blueberries, almonds, seaweed, walnuts, pumpkin seeds, supplementing curcumin, which is turmeric, essentially making a project, a culinary project of regulating cortisol levels. What else contributes to amygdala health? Sleep. These are going to be recurring themes throughout the whole series, diet and sleep. Making a routine out of a bedtime, training your mind to shut down at a certain hour, and creating optimal conditions for maintaining deep sleep. So I have my eye mask, I have my blackout curtains, I have my white noise machine. I use all of those things. And I always sleep through the night. Still, and I can tell when my bedtime fluctuates and my wake time fluctuates greatly, whoo, do I get ants in my pants. Third one, meditation. Now, I used to think the purpose of the activity of meditation was to relax, but it's really a kind of disciplined thinking where you learn to actually pay closer attention to your thoughts through practice and repetition, those ants, those automatic negative thoughts that can often take over and, you know, produce that effect in this part of the brain once they kind of build up, can be acknowledged and pondered and dismissed. And it's quite nice. So, and it's really something that I found you need to make a practice of. I do it 5 days a week. It's part of my Monday through Friday morning routine. The changes are not immediate. Like I thought, oh, I'm stressed, I should meditate. That's not how it works. It's a more subtle long-term payoff. Having free time, but also mindful free time. Like you're not really doing anything if you're, there's nothing wrong with watching TV. There's great shows, you know, Game of Thrones, Californication, Sopranos, Firefly, Dollhouse, Full House. But a kind of mindful free time, a walk in the woods. How nice. And I find it very important to, you know, break up my workday. I felt much better when I don't suddenly realize that I've been sitting in my desk for 3 hours. Every 45 minutes, I'm up and moving and disconnecting, unplugging from what I was just doing and just being. I know it sounds gay, but it helps. To that, I would add journaling. 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes at night, perfect for people who really don't want to journal, but they think it has some benefits. 5 minute journal. I filled mine, so now I'm just basically, I do a quick blurb, just kind of a dump of whatever thoughts are stirring. Maybe that takes a minute or two. Write down 3 things that I'm grateful for, 3 ways to make today great, and then some kind of positive affirmation. When I go to bed, 3 great things about that day and a suggestion for how to do better the next day. And it's a good way to just kind of see what's in there and get it out. Because if I don't pay attention to that stuff, it can build up and become quite the cacophony of epinephrine-fueled mayhem. So if you are one of these, and you know, the journaling and the meditation, they relate to another really valuable piece of advice for, again, regulating the function of this delicious little almond cluster we call our amygdala. It's 2 of them, really. There's one in each hemisphere of the brain, by the way. Not that that's super important. Creating routines. Routines for me produce a kind of stability that allow me to absorb the unexpected or unfortunate events that used to provoke a kind of anxiousness or feeling of destabilization. And I'll still stand by the number one piece of advice that we first gave on this show back in 2013 for reducing stress and anxiety. Get f***ing organized. Don't overdo it. Don't become super dependent on these systems of organization. But when we first did that series on GTD back in 2013 called Presence and Productivity, the problem that I was trying to address was stress/anxiety. And so this is more of a behavioral approach. But if life is filled with chaos, if life is filled with disorganization, it is going to produce even more stressors. You're going to feel that swarm of bees around you, of all these open loops that could easily be captured and closed. You're going to be late for things. You're going to completely miss things and forget things. You're going to have to worry about criticism from others because you're so disorganized. Get your shit together, man, they say. So having that stability of routine and having a reliable method, not over reliable, but a reliable method of managing all of the inputs in life is really, really important. So we've made it halfway through the brain and we're going to take a break. And in the second part of this episode, 433B, we'll do the back nine of the brain, if you don't mind. That's golf talk. Basal ganglia, which plays an important role in implicit memories, will touch on the mammillary body of the brain, which plays a role in recognition memory, but just barely. We're just going to nick that. We'll spend a lot of time on the hippocampus, which could be considered the memory hub of our brains. And then we'll go all the way to the back, the cerebellum, which is procedural memory. So I hope you learned a lot today. I hope it wasn't too much. God, can you believe I was going to try and do that whole brain in one show? Thanks for listening, everybody. I look forward to your feedback. Remember, I'm just trying to hit the basics here. So if you feel like there's really, really important aspects of this that I neglected, please post in the group. Don't email me. I'm behind on emails due to my 13-day email vacation. So post it in the Facebook group. Use the hashtag memory condition, one word. Okay, take care.
This is a song about parts of the brain. I'm singing it to memorize the name. The ideas here may be simplistic, but matching meaning and rhyme is a tough logistic. Cerebral cortex has four main lobes with names from the nearby skull bones. Frontal does the thinking, occipital deals with vision, parietal senses objects, and temporal listens. Inside these lobes there's specialties like Broca's area, which produces speech. Wernicke's area handles language comprehension, and the motor cortex is for moving with intention. Sensory cortex handles perception of touch, pain, temperature, and proprioception. There's two outer brain parts that are distinct. They seem separate, but everything is linked. The cerebellum does balance and coordination, and it has our memorized movement archive. The brainstem sets heartbeat and respiration and other things we need to survive. The brain's inner parts are unique. Cut the corpus callosum to take a peek. The thalamus handles signal routing, and the amygdala's emotions can have you shouting. The hippocampus does our long-term memory saving, and the hypothalamus makes our sex and food cravings. The anterior cingulate cortex, yeah, the anterior cingulate cortex learns from mistakes. And in controlling movement, the basal ganglia is the brakes. The brain parts list is much longer indeed, but for my class assignment, this is all I need.